14. Faceless International. What will the world look like at the end of the 21st century? Which geopolitical competitor will wield dominant political authority over all of the world's 6 billion people? The choices are stark: autocracy, democracy, or theocracy. Russia and its strategic partners are already moving down a pathway toward Lenin's vision of a party-state autocracy at the core of a geopolitically successful Marxism. In Gramsci's formula, Lenin's geopolitical structure does not provide a framework for conquering the world, as was the case with Soviet Marxism-Leninism. Rather, Gramsci accommodated Lenin's geopolitical vision in a far more subtle way. Gramsci's focus is on conquering the mind of civil society, or acquiring a Marxist hegemony over the minds of the population that must be won. The key for Russia and America's homegrown progressive socialist Marxist collaborators is to change the cultural outlook, the outward face of the people in the capitalist West towards socialist Marxist governance. The power to control the minds of the people is a prerequisite for transforming the culture, and changing their worldview is key to their embracing global socialist governance. In order to win the geopolitical competition with the capitalist West and militant Islam, Russia would have to mute its ideological rhetoric. For starters, Malachi Martin counsels in The Keys of This Blood, Marxists would have to drop all Leninist shibboleths. It wouldn't do to rant about revolution and dictatorship of the proletariat and workers' paradise. Instead, according to Gramsci, Marxists would have to exalt such ideas as national consensus and national unity and national pacification. When the Soviet Union dissolved itself in 1991 and evolved politically into the Russian Federation, it also abandoned Marxism-Leninism as its official governing ideology and adopted the cultural Marxism of Antonio Gramsci as a guide for its relations with the United States and others in the capitalist West. Suffering through the transition years in the 1990s, Russia regained its feet under Vladimir Putin, who painstakingly rebuilt Russia in the image of the Soviet Union without the nuisance value of Marxism-Leninism. For the Kremlin, the exercise of mind control over the Russian people was possible through state-controlled capitalism in a new party-state governing system. Since an extension of global dictatorship by military means had become impossible in a nuclear-armed world, Gramsci's formula for cultural revolution provided the right political medicine to win control of the minds of all the world's people. Christopher Story, editor of the British-based Soviet Analyst, explains how the phony coup against Mikhail Gorbachev in August 1991 resulted in a cosmetic ban of the Soviet Communist Party, a move that could be unbanned. Today, Story says, the existence of the CPSU, Communist Party of the Soviet Union, is openly acknowledged by Soviet/Russian and Western communist sources. Soviet Russia has not given up on creating a communist world order. Rather, Gorbachev, in implementing the Andropov Plan, flipped from the military confrontational tactics of Marxism-Leninism to Antonio Gramsci's far more subtle cultural revolution to win control of the minds of peoples in targeted countries. In order to make this grand stage play realistic, Gorbachev choreographed the top-to-bottom restructuring of the Soviet-Russian Communist Party. Christopher Story explains that the party was splintered into factions across the entire political spectrum, creating controlled opposition to establish the conditions for democratism, fake democracy. The play acting was extended to the Soviet republics, whose new independent status would be later fashioned into a new internationalist unity, one that in 2008 is quite evident in Central Asia and some of the East European countries. Georgia, Poland, and the Baltic states appear most troublesome for Moscow, but its flood of energy cash offers the Kremlin new political options. Meanwhile, the Russians are moving confidently toward an eventual convergence with Europe. Warning the Russian people in May 2007 of a dangerous global environment, Vladimir Putin said, "In our time, these threats are not diminishing. And in these new threats, as during the time of the Third Reich, are the same contempt for human life and the same claims of exceptionality and diktat in the New World." There is little doubt Putin's reference to a modern-day Third Reich is a code word for the United States. By 2008, one could marvel at the changes in the new Russia, while at the same time acknowledging that the key pillars of the Soviet system remained in place. The privileged elite, the nomenklatura, remained intact and, thanks to the economic boom fueled by higher energy prices, they have more money than they ever could have dreamed of possessing. The KGB changed its name to the FSB, and former members of Soviet intelligence and security services became key decision-makers at all levels of the Russian government, the Siloviki. And the Communist Party, which had disappeared with the demise of the Soviet Union, reappeared in Gramscian Mufti during the December 2007 elections for the State Duma Parliament. The United Party, winning nearly two-thirds of the popular vote, assured a continuation of Vladimir Putin's rule, this time as Prime Minister. With the United Party's dominance, the familiar Soviet Russia party state is back in power. Prime Minister Putin has a clear pathway for rebuilding Russia's ground and air forces, restoring a naval presence in the Mediterranean, exercising initiatives to bring about a Russian-European convergence using transformation tools straight out of Antonio Gramsci's cultural Marxism, and waging a long-term geopolitical competition vis-a-vis the capitalist West and militant Islam. The secret Soviet Russian International Department, which is now Gramsci-oriented, or today's common term, as Christopher Story calls it, is located in Moscow and at the Presidio, a former military base in San Francisco. It is from the latter location that Gorbachev's foundation is linked with the Institute for Policy Studies and its solar system of organizations. Curiously, the Gorbachev Foundation was created under a cover name, Tamilpay Institute, at the Presidio in San Francisco on April 10, 1991. For months before the ostensible August KGB coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. Following the dissolution of the Soviet Union and disappearance of the Communist Party on December 31, 1991, the Tamilpay Institute's name was changed to the Gorbachev Foundation. Many of the foundation's large staff were former members of the International Department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, which was responsible for many active measures carried out against the West. Galitzin explained how Gorbachev adopted Lenin's instructions in 1921 for party members to be prepared to resort to all sorts of stratagems, maneuvers, illegal methods, evasions, and subterfuge in carrying out the recycled new economic policy. Gorbachev, Galitzin emphasized, is a committed Leninist who is carrying out a communist renewal as a means towards the ultimate conquest of Western democracies. Boilerplate aside, the Gorbachev Foundation was created to cast grand global images on the wall of Plato's cave depicting humanity coming together in a geopolitical design of world socialist governance, elevating Antonio Gramsci's secular solution from a national to an international level. Mikhail Gorbachev spun a picture of worldwide happiness in which all humankind would join hands and skip through a green meadow in the freshness of a spring sun. The reality outside of the cave, however, revealed Gorbachev's world socialism and governance to be one in which liberty would become an all but a remote memory and humanity impoverished to levels below today's worst imagination. The supposedly crazy man Anatoly Galitzin warned the CIA in 1989 that, as Russia entered perestroika, Moscow would intensify the efforts of Gorbachev to engage the American elite in cooperation over the environment, space, disarmament, and the joint solution of social, political, economic, environmental, military, and international problems. Galitzin also said that Soviet, Russian, agents of influence in the United States will redouble their attempts to act as catalysts in promoting restructuring and convergence. These actions by the Kremlin would be equivalent to Gramsci's Marxist formula of moving quietly into open societal spaces to position oneself for an eventual ascent to power. Mikhail Gorbachev, riding the crest of a wave of popularity as the man who dared to slay the communist dragon and end the Cold War, immediately went about the process of undermining political loyalty to American democratic principles and national sovereignty by spinning an image of global governance, with socialism tucked away in the shadows. He began his propaganda campaign in an address to the United Nations, appropriately on December 7, 1988. The 47th anniversary of Japan's sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party Gorbachev outlined some of the major disinformation themes that would flow in different guises in the days to come. Further world progress is now possible only through the search for consensus of all mankind, in movement toward a new world order. The world community must learn to shape and direct the process in such a way as to preserve civilization, to make it safe for all and more pleasant for normal life. It is a question of cooperation that could be more accurately called co-creation and co-development. The formula of development, at another's expense, is becoming outdated. In light of present realities, genuine progress by infringing upon the rights and liberties of man and peoples, or at the expense of nature, is impossible. In this quotation, Mr. Gorbachev calls for humankind to find the consensus necessary to move toward a new world order and a coming together, read, an end to sovereignty. What he called co-creation and co-development masked an intent to bring about a convergence of capitalism and socialism, first in Europe and then in North America. The development at another's expense is a criticism of Europe's partnership agreements with African states and U.S. free trade policies in Latin America. It is a short tiptoe through the enchanted forest of socialism from these comments to reach the far left's fiery anti-globalization movement. In retrospect, the contemporary geopolitical competition between Russia, the capitalist West, and the Salafist/Wahhabist began with Gorbachev's 1988 New World Order speech at the United Nations. Gorbachev's propaganda effort shifted to the Gorbachev Foundation after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The foundation was financed by millions of dollars from Americans with deep pockets who were honored to be recognized as being one of America's elite by the former General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party. The money was used to underwrite rather extravagant gatherings of these supposed opinion makers in this State of the World Forum, whose meetings were designed to lead the attendees to the image of a new world order. A third element of the propaganda strategy was satisfied by the Gorbachev Foundation Nerve Center in Moscow, which had a large supporting staff. In the words of British Al Christopher Story, a former aide to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the former international department of the CPSU Central Committee has been relabeled the Gorbachev Foundation, which indicates Gorbachev's continuing importance as an implementer of the Andropov strategy. Fourth, Christopher Story discovered a replacement Marxist doctrine to have been drawn from Antonio Gramsci's revisionism and at the core of restructuring right from the beginning. Gorbachev removed the shackles from the economic dependency of Eastern Europe as the Soviet Union faced bankruptcy and had no realistic way of dodging an oncoming economic train wreck. Sometimes a winning strategy is to lose at the beginning, in a controlled way, so as to pick up a new direction and win later. And fifth, Mr. Gorbachev's new book, To Understand Perestroika, was published in the Russian language in 2006. Reviews in English reported how Gorbachev discusses perestroika and accounts for some of the miscalculations made in implementing policy. He also revealed the evolution of his views on socialism, which led him to embrace a social democratic scenario in Russia's development. Curiously, the book was right on time to try to smooth the ruffled feathers in the West about Russia's increasing tilt toward authoritarian governance. First, miscalculations, as expressed by Gorbachev in the 2006 interviews, were steeped in disinformation of what he wanted people to believe. After all, he's the guy that killed communism, or at least that is what many believe. Secondly, social democratic is a euphemism for the weak-wrist socialist governments in Europe, all members of the Socialist International. Convergence with Europe is Moscow's initial step in trying to erase the European transatlantic alliance with the United States. One can also trace Mr. Gorbachev's propaganda line through the proceedings hosted by the State of the World Forum meetings from the San Francisco-based Gorbachev Foundation operation. Founded in 1995, the World Forum's boilerplate states that it works with partners worldwide to gather together the creative genius on the planet in a search for solutions to critical global challenges. Co-chairs numbered 20 or so, including some moderates, but heavily tilted to the left, including Ruud Lubbers, Rigoberta Menchú-Tum, Ted Turner, Maurice Strong, and others. Strikingly successful in raising money for the World Forum proceedings, about 260 partner corporations, government agencies, foundations, and individuals donated. Included among the cash cows were the usual left-wing suspects, Heinz Foundation, John D., and Catherine T., MacArthur Foundation, John Merck Fund, Plowshares Fund, Union of Concerned Scientists, W. Alton Jones Foundation, and others with pronounced left-wing orientations. Many hard-nosed, profit-oriented, major businesses also took the bait. Gorbachev used the State of the World Forum to promote a paradigm shift, a model amenable to the cultural Marxism ideology of Antonio Gramsci. Again and again, writer and analyst Barrett Kias explains, the communist leader and his handpicked Council of the Wise, or Global Brain Trust, told the assembly of more than 1,000 guests and participants that new inclusive universal values must replace the Judeo-Christian worldview. The unstated socialist view would replace familiar trappings of the sovereignty-based Westphalia system with new values and the definition of a new global perspective. For Gorbachev, the old beliefs and political systems, as writer Barry Kass observed, must be abandoned. By guiding state of the world forum discussion to correct answers, albeit with a variety of perspectives allowed, Gorbachev strived to motivate 1,000 or so elites toward endorsement of the new global paradigm. Gorbachev needed to screen out contradictory points during the sessions, especially the Judeo-Christian values at the root of American liberal government. Another filter might screen out the idea of national sovereignty as being immutable. He also tried to inculcate the idea that individual freedom guaranteed behind sovereign borders was an outmoded concept. Barrett Kiosk summarized Mr. Gorbachev's plan for a united world in a telling conclusion. This new paradigm turns all our American values upside down. Gorbachev may tout consensus and synthesis as the means to peace and security, but his ambiguous blends would drown Western capitalism in the sea of global socialism. Remember, his idea of democratizing the world eliminates all the human rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. He demands the abolition of poverty everywhere, but at the cost of American resources. He wants equality for all except the elite ruling class. In July 2006, an apparently frustrated Mikhail Gorbachev struck out against the United States. Americans have a severe disease, worse than AIDS. It's called the Winners' Complex, he said. You want an American style of government, here in Russia. That will not work. A year later, Gorbachev was back on his high horse, plugging global socialist governance and railing about the United States trying to build an empire after the Cold War. The Americans gave birth to the idea of a new empire. World leadership by a single power, and what followed? What has followed are unilateral actions, wars, ignoring the UN Security Council, international law, and the will of the people, even the American people. In April 2008, President Vladimir Putin, just a few weeks before he became prime minister, addressed the Russian people. Throughout history, Russia and her citizens have accomplished, and today are still accomplishing, a truly historic task. Maintaining the governance of a vast territory, preserving a unique commonwealth of peoples while occupying a major place in world affairs, calls not only for enormous toil. It calls also for enormous sacrifices and privations on the part of our people. Such has been Russia's thousand-year history. Such is the way in which it has retained its place as a mighty nation. We do not have the right to forget this. The meaning of Putin's words for the Russian mindset is explained by Andrei Pyatkovsky of the Hudson Institute. The speech served as the fateful sounding of the nationalist trumpet, a secret signal to his supporters that he would propel our revolution. A conservative, nationalistic revolution, which would lead to a renaissance of the fatherland's worldwide imperial greatness. Pyatkovsky's analysis was right on target. When taking the oath of office on May 8, 2008, Putin told the assembled legislators assembled at the Duma that our resources are sufficient to achieve even more complex, even more ambitious tasks and goals. I'm using our accumulated potential effectively and judiciously. A World War II victory parade was held at Red Square on May 9, 2008, the first such demonstration since 1990, revealing a broad range of technologically outdated tanks, missiles, bombers, and fighter planes. Naval forces are also in disrepair and in need of updating. Putin promised to reverse the deterioration of Russian military forces. As a down payment, the Russian military budget has risen from $2 billion in 2002 to $42 billion in 2008. The West should take Prime Minister Putin's promise to upgrade Russia's military readiness in the immediate future with a grave seriousness. Russia's grand theatrical production, the Andropov Plan, drew its final curtain in the wake of the Army's heavy-handed, bloody crushing of tiny Georgia in August 2008. For more than two decades, the Kremlin's play acting had presented a Potemkin image of an internationally responsible democratic government. The stage play, based on deception and deceit, was the key ingredient for buying the time necessary for Soviet Russia's Marxist renewal and restructuring the Kremlin's influence over its foreign agents of influence. ACTI brought an end to the Cold War marked by mutual nuclear deterrence and an armed standoff in Europe. The Berlin Wall tumbled down, captive nations inside the Soviet Empire were freed, and nuclear weapons pared back. Communism in its Marxist-Leninist form disappeared. The Federation of Russia emerged from the controlled crumbling of the Soviet Union. These were heady times. Act II was focused in the wild and woolly 1990s as momentous economic turmoil and crime dominated the stage. Behind the scenes, however, one could find previous Soviet power centers operating very actively. While the KGB moved the country's treasury out the back door to overseas banks and investments, nomenklatura, about 1.5 million elites of the former Soviet Communist Party, those holding senior positions in the government and the enterprises, moved through the front door to purchase Soviet state industries for pennies on the dollar. Millionaires were created overnight, and a few took their ill-gotten gains to billions of dollars. As Act II came to its closing scene at the end of the 1990s, a seemingly pedestrian and controllable former KGB officer strolled onto the stage. After a stint as chief of the Federal Security Service, FSB, a happy-faced KGB, Vladimir Putin became president of Russia in March 2000. Act III opened with a bang as President Putin moved quickly to tame the excesses of the 1990s and instill discipline in the politics and economy of the state. After he chased two billionaires out of the country and jailed another, the other fell into line. There was a new sheriff in town. Quasi-independent regional governors were cashiered and Putin's men put them in their place. The free press was silenced as a dozen or more journalists and writers met untimely deaths at the hands of persons unknown. President Putin danced with President Bush. Looking into the American president's eyes, Putin saw a man he could dupe. Meanwhile, world demand for oil and natural gas soared, raising prices with them and filling Russia's coffers in the pockets of the nomenklatura. Hundreds of former KGB men, the Siloviki, found second careers at all levels of government, solidifying Putin's iron fist. Marxism-Leninism was dead, but secretly the Soviet Russians flipped to adoption of Antonio Gramsci's cultural Marxism, which is hidden inside the Gorbachev Foundation in Moscow and San Francisco. Gramsci's stealthy formula for revolution, which allows the creation of mind control over the targeted people by destroying their cultural values and replacing them with socialist principles, will allow the Kremlin to Marxize their enemies without firing a shot. Moscow's strategy is to achieve global dominance over time through its agents of influence in countries throughout the capitalist West. The relationship between Russia and the Gramscist in Europe, the United States, and elsewhere is not a direct or mechanical one. Rather, it is an organic structure in which Russian and foreign elements of Gramsci's cultural Marxism are integrated naturally into a unified organic whole. They are mutually supportive in destroying the societal values in their respective countries and replacing them with Marxist principles through a new societal mind control, hegemony. Act IV opened in December 2007 with a huge victory by the United Russia Party in the Duma Parliament that allowed Vladimir Putin to change governing chairs from president to prime minister, thereby preserving the fiction of a democratic Russia. During the same period, the Campaign for America's Future, a front for the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, began a political campaign toward building a new majority for real change. The radical left IPS, a close friend of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, since 1963 had created a vast solar system of organizations following the Gramsci formula for cultural revolution at the federal, state, municipal, county, and community levels throughout the United States. The culture war to destroy American values is aimed at Marxizing America and making it possible to win political power through the ballot box when the brainwashing towards socialist governance will begin in earnest. Russia's long-planned, ruthless assault on Georgia turned off the theater lights. The two-decades-old stage play was over. The new Russia, based on a party state, Gramscian Marxism, government-owned industries, and an urge to bully its neighbors back into line are but the first steps of the Kremlin's long-range strategy. In conjunction with its foreign agents of influence, Russia is striving to create a one-world socialist governance by the end of the century without firing a shot. The capitalist West, the second competitor for world dominance, will be able to rival Russia and its strategic partners by emphasizing its democratic strengths and defending its culture against the assaults from the far left. Economic globalization, individual liberty, and democracy are the centerpiece activities and strengths of the capitalist West, and if relations with countries in the Southern Hemisphere are managed on a fair and balanced basis, it could provide a winning edge for the great democracies over the long term. The capitalist West, however, is also vulnerable to inroads by cultural Marxism in Europe and the United States. The progressive socialist Marxists strive to corrupt the Judeo-Christian cultures and substitute their own hard left mind control framework to guide the societies toward global socialist governance. Europe is already under the strong influence of the radical left and may disintegrate under the demographic pressure of a plummeting birth rate and a rapidly growing Muslim population from the Middle East and Africa. The far left's war against America, the culture war, has been underway since the 1960s using Antonio Gramsci's formula for cultural transformation leading to the staircase of power. The left's ideological soldiers have successfully penetrated much of American society, including the public schools and universities across the nation. Progressive socialist Marxists also have taken over the Democrat Party, a long-standing goal. From its current position, the radical left envisions gaining political control through the ballot box and then putting into place a series of wealth redistribution measures, curbs on free economics, and an eventual end of U.S. national sovereignty as the country joins others in creating socialist world governance. Gramsci exhorted his followers to join the capitalists in the West, participate in their profit-seeking, in their social do-gooding, in their international peacemaking and peacekeeping structures, in health standards and living standards, and yes, even in their profession of ethical and religious goals, Malachi Martin explains. Become members of the global home they are building, genuine members of their human family, collaborating and liberating all men from slavery and meaninglessness of daily life. Progressive socialist Marxists are encouraged to take this path, not for the sake of penetrating capitalist countries, but to corrupt their Christian cultural basis, the strength and superstructure of their Judeo-Christian cultures. Do this as a prerequisite to exercise control over people's minds. This makes socialist politics at the mass level possible and encourages an eventual extension towards socialist world governance. During the Cold War, the Institute for Policy Studies and its broad solar system of shining stars were of enormous assistance to adversaries of the United States. Scott Stephen Powell, from his experience of working inside IPS, stated in no uncertain terms, in addition to generating programs that support active measures campaigns, the IPS network produces enormous volumes of literature presenting ideas on a full range of issues which often reflect the Soviet line, but which are written in contemporary terms and style that appeal to popular American sentiments. Powell took his analysis one step further by listing seven specific Soviet aims, each of which are unchanged and now reflect Russia's strategic goals. 1. To influence world and American public opinion against U.S. military and political programs by suggesting they are the major cause of international conflict and crisis. 2. To demonstrate that the U.S. is an aggressive, colonialist, and imperialist power, and demonstrate that its policies and goals are incompatible with the ambitions of the underdeveloped world. 3. To isolate the United States from its allies and friends and discredit those who cooperate with the U.S. 4. To discredit U.S. policies and representatives in the eyes of its citizens and the world by creating or exacerbating splits within the nation. 5. To discredit and weaken American intelligence services and expose their personnel. 6. To confuse world public opinion regarding the aggressive nature of Russian policies. 7. To create a favorable environment for the execution of Russian foreign policy. Powell concluded in 1987 that, from its inception, IPS, in its words and in its activities, has assisted the Soviet Union in attaining these seven objectives. Emphasis added, there is no evidence that this IPS-Kremlin relationship has changed significantly since the dissolution of the Soviet Union 3 years later, December 1990. On the contrary, a German journalist reported that in the mid-1980s Gorbachev was consulting with a member of the Transnational Institute and other American-European collaborators associated with IPS during his final preparations for implementing the Andropov Plan. This accounts for the madness unleashed among European radicals during the early 1990s in striving to understand and apply Gramsci's Cultural Revolution formula to their open activities. Moreover, the anti-globalization campaign and the anti-war protest in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere all supported Russian goals as enumerated as Soviet aims by S. Stephen Powell in 1987. IPS and its henchmen played instrumental roles in the planning and conduct of both the anti-globalization and anti-war protests since the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. Each of the major protests in the United States were planned by Marxist-Leninists, World Workers' Party/Answer, and Marxists, United for Peace and Justice/IPS. The same was true in Europe, where anarcho-communists also played a major role in the protests. The Institute for Policy Studies also has worked hard since its inception to penetrate and influence the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate. The objective from the beginning has been to influence the policy-making process of the United States. The cord that binds the multitude of IPS projects and activities, John Rees of the Malden Institute wrote in 1983, is its effort to influence U.S. policies along the lines ultimately favorable to the interests of the Soviet Union. The IPS umbilical was refreshed in the 1990s and is still connected to the Kremlin through the Gorbachev Foundation, a Russian front for integrating international cooperation in support of the Gramscian Project to develop a socialist world governance led by Moscow. The U.S. Congress remains a target for facilitating progress toward progressive socialist Marxist political dominance inside the United States for the purpose of triggering a cultural revolution that will lead the American people to accept a government headed by a cabal of socialists and Marxists. Not only are IPS collaborators flooded throughout congressional staffs, they are also working closely with members of the House and Senate. The key instrument for influencing U.S. policy is the 70-plus representatives and one senator that make up the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is largely owned and operated by the Institute for Policy Studies. The IPS Solar System of Organizations has marshaled all of its resources for the 2008 presidential election, based on the belief that the collapse of conservatism has finally opened the door for their accession to power. The progressive socialist Marxist radical left is driving many of the social and foreign policy debates. Convinced that conservatives have formed a circular firing squad, Robert Borisich, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, says that it's time for a change, a new era has begun. The Campaign for America's Future is convinced that Democrats are going to win big this November 2008, but it's not taking any chances, Joseph D'Agostino writes. The group has moved to the forefront of progressive activism and is pushing for a permanent political realignment that would usher in a new era of big government. The Institute for Policy Studies and its Solar System of Organizations have a major influence on policymaking in the Congress, many state legislatures, and municipalities. With its international reach to Europe and Russia through the Gorbachev Foundation, constellations of shining stars also influence U.S. foreign policy. With the exception of President Jimmy Carter and, to some degree, Bill Clinton, the progressive socialist Marxist movement has been shut out of the White House. The IPS directors and members of their network are drooling to once again have one of their acolytes as President of the United States. With the assistance of George Soros and his gang of fellow plutocrats, the far left has taken over by developing fronts inside its shadow party secreted within the Democrat Party. It was from here that the radical left placed all its chips on Barack Obama. Presidential candidate Barack Obama offers Americans change we can believe in. Obama's background reveals that he has been steeped in the organizational and battle tactics for social revolution by the renowned community organizer Saul Alinsky. The late Alinsky, he died in 1972, developed a whole set of tactics to touch off a successful cultural revolution. A wholesale revolution whose ultimate objective is the systematic acquisition of power by a purportedly oppressed segment of the population and the radical transformation of America's social and economic structure. He adds that the goal is to foment enough public discontent, moral confusion, and outright chaos to spark the social upheaval, a revolution whose foot soldiers view the status quo as fatally flawed and wholly unworthy of salvation. The idea is to energize the poor and less fortunate, or what Marx might have called the lumpen proletariat. Barack Obama taught workshops in the 1980s on the Alinsky method, took part in community organizing, and conducted training activities for future leaders while he was with ACORN, an IPS far-left collaborator. For the radical left, thirsting more than two decades, Barack Obama is the perfect front man for advancing the progressive socialist Marxist program for transforming American culture. Obama aligned himself with the radical left from the beginning of his career. His community organizing for ACORN became his early schoolhouse to entering the IPS solar system and stunning the personalities inside with his exceptional rhetorical skills. While he was busy internalizing a radical policy perspective and preparing for a future in politics, the far left groomed him for what may become his future in the White House. When one combines the perspective of Obama in the White House and with the Institute for Policy Studies helping to shape policies in the U.S. House and Senate, plus several state legislatures, one might believe that it is game over. For America's traditional culture embracing liberty and liberal democratic government, militant Islam, the third geopolitical competitor for dominant global authority, is focused on restoration of a world Islamic caliphate. Wielding a double-edged sword, one side sharpened for terrorist attacks and the other dulled for waging a theocratic civilizational jihad, or a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within, so that Allah's religion is made victorious over all other religions. A major success for militant Islam is in Europe, where, from all indications, the growing Muslim presence will be in a position to win political control through the ballot box in 15 to 20 years. The capitalist West is already at war against Islamic jihadism. George Weigel argues persuasively that the 21st century will be one in which rapidly advancing modernization coincides with an explosion in religious conviction and passion, which will pose a specific and mortal threat to the civilization of the West and to the United States as the lead society of the West. The 9/11 attacks created a strategic moment for Americans. The echo of Paul Revere's warning rolled across the land, prompting Americans to take up arms and attempt to help Iraq achieve democratic governance that would serve as a demonstration effect to the Islamic world. How democracy could resolve their concerns about modernity and offer a preferable alternative to endless war against the West. But America's effort was undermined by the centuries-old differences between Shiite and Sunni Muslims, intervention by Iran, and the far left's anti-war. Anti-democratic actions that prompted many Americans to take to the streets in protest against the conflict. This grand jihad of destroying Western civilization from the inside is rightly characterized by Bruce Bauer as a cultural jihad. Militant Islam touts Sharia law as having dominion over all Muslims, even when their infractions of the law, including murder, occur in non-Muslim countries. At the same time, militants have choreographed an attack on Western freedoms of speech and expression by the brutal 2004 murder of Theo van Gogh in Amsterdam for his film about oppression of women and the publication of satirical cartoons in Danish newspapers in 2005 through riots, mayhem, and even killings worldwide. Western societies learn to censor themselves out of fear or sympathy for Islam's followers. No matter how repressive a foreign regime may be, the West, including Americans, have allowed their concern for what Islamists may think or do to influence their words and actions. Intimidation, even implied threats, are enough for self-censoring, resulting in a loss of liberties previously enjoyed. Already, militant Islam has set the train of civilizational jihad into motion. The United States, like Europe, is accommodating the Muslim Sharia demands. This has become a kind of self-timotization similar to what has been occurring in Europe. Accommodating the cultural practices of others is about good manners. But such accommodations under the threat of physical harm, real or implied, or verbal denunciation leads an infringement of basic liberties enjoyed by all Americans. By rendering deferential preference to Muslims under pressure is what Bruce Brauer correctly calls cultural surrender. To make matters worse, the U.S. Departments of State and Homeland Security have designed their own politically correct words for use in describing Islamic terrorism. Officials are being advised to use vague terms like terrorist or violent extremist, while avoiding such descriptive terms as jihadists or Islamicist to describe American enemies. There always seems to be someone in the room, when discussing the Muslim word jihad, that hastens to make the point that it refers to the internal struggle to follow God's guidance. True enough. But Andrew C. McCarthy, author of Willful Blindness, a memoir of the jihad, says that if jihad truly were a sublime summons to become a better person, It is not entirely clear how plowing jumbo jets into skyscrapers and mass murdering civilians could achieve the sheen of the sacerdotal in the eyes of the faithful. Simply stated, jihad is and has always been about forcible conquest. He adds that the jihadist project is to remove all barriers to the establishment of the Sharia, which is a prerequisite for Islam's dominance. Columnist Diana West calls the new government guide words that work and words that don't crazy, and for good reason. The latest nonsense from government bureaucrats would label the war on Islamic terror as being a global struggle for security and progress. References to caliphate are banned and substituted with global totalitarian state. In addition, jihad is censored and so is Islamofascist. Diana West has it right, animating the directive, written with considerable input from unidentified American Muslim experts, is the delusional belief that what we say or don't say has transformative power over Muslim attitudes and behaviors regarding Islamic terrorism, the Islamic Caliphate, the advance of Islamic law, Sharia, and the so-called war on Islamic terror. Americans are not Europeans. One should expect the public to reject such bureaucratic derangement in the U.S. government. The war against America by Islamic terrorists is both violent and psychological. Propaganda and disinformation in the soft civilizational jihad is dedicated to preparing Americans for rule under the Islamic Sharia. Islam, as a religion, provides a smokescreen for both the violent and soft jihads. Playing word games and defining politically correct terms that soft-pedal the images of violent and civilizational jihad is a crucial first step toward acceptance of dhimmitid. The Departments of State and Homeland Security seemingly do not understand that words count in a propaganda and disinformation war. It is vital for Americans to withstand the temptations of political correctness and refer to things as they are. Instead of playing shadow puppets on the walls of Plato's cave, government officials should stay focused on the realities of the violent and soft dimensions of jihad. Playing the game of hurt feelings by some Muslims brings the kind of results that has led Europe into the hell of dhimmitid. Things can and do get worse, George Weigel counsels, especially when cultural morale declines. Much of Europe today exhibits a kind of cultural exhaustion that does not bode well for the future. Will Americans follow the European decline, or will they fight back to defend their way of life? Once the culture is torn, Americans may never find their way back to the societal values that have provided more than two centuries of greatness to the nation's democratic experiment of individual freedom and limited government. Moreover, the absence of a coherent culture would compromise the ability of the United States to lead the capitalist West successfully in its 21st century geopolitical competition with Russia and militant Islam. A politically socialized and Marxized United States would leave the world hanging between autocracy and theocracy. In either case, a victory by Russia or the Islamists would be America's death knell, an end of its rich culture based on democracy and individual liberty.